Welcome to the Abbott Appen Podcast, episode 72, a podcast for IT professionals. Hi, I'm Al.
I'm John.
And I'm Jerry.
In this show, we talk about IPv6.
We also talk a little bit about provisioning servers.
And we talk about VPNs. So without further ado, let's get on with the show.
Hey, we're back again. So I've been messing about with at work, doing lots and lots of setting up VPNs to remote customer sites. And the platform we're using at the moment is to connect to these is a device called a Beata, or Beata as well, you can say it. It was an open source firewall product, which was then brought by Brocade, but they actually have re-released, not Brocade, but someone has forked it again, and it's called VYOS.
And VYOS, yeah,
VYOS. So, because I've been doing lots of this, and the new interface hasn't got a web interface yet. The old one has, new one hasn't, and so I've been doing a lot of scripting for that. To creating firewall rules and debugging VPN connections, because we've been connecting to different things like Junipers and checkpoints, FortiGates, and it's just easier to debugging it. So I've basically written a script which I can just copy and paste in the terminal to build the phase 1 and phase 2 tunnel. Then also with that, with just using the debugging command, to actually see when, if the phase 1 or the phase 2 comes up. So that's quite interesting. It's basically, I'm guessing it's just using OpenSwan to do the VPN, but when you kind of do the debugging, it's really detailed. You just have to look for the right command to see when it phase 1 comes up. And then you can, normally phase 1 doesn't come up because you've got a mismatch of different, on the different, encryption, algorithms on either end. Yeah, and then when you can then do phase 2, and normally again, that's normally probably again either the MIF range of the algorithms, or you haven't got the right, is it called the encryption domains, what you're sending down the paths. And also, because the reason we're using these Viatas to do this, what we're doing is because currently we've got they're sitting behind a Cisco firewall, which is doing context modes. And which means like you can, it's running virtual like firewalls on top of each other, and you can't run VPNs apparently on the version we have. So we basically just pass through the VPN ports through internally, and that, because that means the firewall's got an internal IP address, and when it requires to build a tunnel, if you don't specify that internal IP address on the other end, it won't authenticate, because it's looking for a public IP address and not the public private IP address of the device we've got. So yes, that's really interesting. And also we were also looking at, because I've been working with some firewall guys, because obviously all they do is firewalls, they were teaching me about looking at the actual packet captures to see if the actual packets were going through, because one of the server guys hadn't put a right route on, so the traffic wasn't getting passed through the tunnel. So the guy was showing me that if you use something like Wireshark or something, there's a command on this box called T-Shark, which you can run, and it will basically just show you all the open connections as they come in. So we could prove that, I did this and I basically proved that the traffic was going through the firewall, and because the guy said he couldn't see it at the other end, but I was proving that the traffic was actually getting in the tunnel because I could see the T-Shark was actually doing it.
You're basically describing sort of about 6 out of the 10 years I worked in the firewall team there.
Yeah.
Funny story, just as an aside, we were working with a Windows laptop today, and we found it had 2 firewalls running. It had the Windows firewall and a McAfee firewall that had obviously been installed by the sort of bloatware that gets put on laptops. So after a lot of head scratching, we disabled the second firewall and everything started working.
So you were saying before about setting up your VPN tunnels and the encryption domains. Effectively, so some people refer to encryption domains as what the interesting traffic is. So you define what's interesting at each end of the tunnel. Something that we've found defining firewalls, VPNs between checkpoint firewalls is that a checkpoint firewall, you can define a single encryption domain for everything that's on the box, or an encryption domain per VPN tunnel. So you can actually have more sources on your local connection than you actually expose, than the other end is looking for.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to have exactly the same matches for the subnets, for the subnet ranges. So if you've got a /24 and the other end's got a /16, or if you've got a /32 and the other end's got a /24, it's not going to build the tunnel. So the tunnel has to match exactly at both ends. What else was there I was going to mention? Oh, yeah. You said about how the tunnels that you're building, you've got a single script that just defines it all. So phase one is almost like an outer wrapper that authenticates the phase two, the inner wrapper. And your encryption domain is specified at phase two. And your, but you also, I don't entirely understand why, but you have almost like two layers of encryption. You've got your outer encryption and authentication, which is typically something like AES-256 and SHA-512 or something like that. And then you have an inner encryption.
Is that something like with, I know with SSH, you've got the asymmetric key exchange thing going on at the beginning of the connection, and then that establishes an encrypted tunnel, and then it's a symmetric encryption within the encrypted tunnel because that's less computationally expensive.
Yeah, you might actually, yeah, that makes a lot of sense now that you say that. Because, yeah, so effectively, your phase one is almost like the trunk that everything else goes down.
Mm.
So, yeah, you're probably right, actually. Your phase, so I'd need to, it's been a while since I've looked at the IPsec spec.
I mean, SSH is a poor man's VPN, so it's probably implemented there. It's probably exists elsewhere.
No, it's not. It's very easy to think of SSH as being a poor man's VPN.
Yeah, I know it's not, but yeah.
SSH is actually a really efficient multiplexer.
Mm.
You were saying that it's probably authenticated, like your private key pair, your asymmetric key exchange to start with. You're probably right. The phase one is your asymmetric key exchange. It's got a timeout on it, so it will reestablish it every time the timeout expires at one end or the other, which is quite useful.
So like 3800 or something.
Different vendors do different time lengths. So some do it in seconds, some do it in microseconds, some do it in minutes. You can specify. I suspect underneath it's all done in seconds.
Yeah.
But, you know, each vendor represents it differently. But the other thing that's interesting about IPsec, for me at least, is that what's actually happening in that phase two is it's actually defining a tunnel per subnet to subnet, which is why the encryption domains have to match, because it's building up a fresh tunnel. So if you've got four subnets at one end and three subnets at the other, that's potentially 3, 6, 9. That's potentially 12 separate tunnels that you're establishing down that single channel. So when you're looking at whether a tunnel's been established, you'll have your phase one tunnel, and then you'll have up to, you know, however many pairings of tunnels you've got at each end. And the thing that always stumps people around IPsec is that even though you've got this IPsec policy that lets traffic flow over the VPN, you still need to have firewall policy that lets it pass the appliance at each end as well. So it's not just like an NENA permit, although it can be at each end, particularly on firewall appliances. You need to also say, oh yes, and by the way, that encryption domain is allowed to talk to anything at the other end of that encryption domain on all of the ports, or, you know, this port, that port, whatever.
Is that generally on the same hardware as the VPNs being set up on?
It depends. There's several different places that will that will do VPNs. So if you're on the, talking about the networking world, your routers can establish VPNs. And there's also VPNs in MPLS, which is a sort of a networking protocol that's much lower level. So those VPNs are not, as far as I know, they're not IPsec VPNs. They're just separate MPLS VPNs. IPsec tends to be terminated on at least one end is on a tunnel terminating box. You don't often tend to see sort of a host.
An IPsec software client, basically.
You know, anyone that has spent any time working with sort of Cisco VPN client or anything like that, that's an IPsec client.
Oh, okay.
But there's two models that you can do with IPsec. There's a few different models, but the two main ones that you tend to see are subnet to subnet, or what used to be referred to as road warrior, which is a dreadful phrase, but which is basically client to server. You don't tend to see client to client very often, although there is an opportunistic encryption that's available in FreeSWAN and OpenSWAN that will let you effectively do server to server encryption. And theoretically, there's no reason why client to client encryption. Theoretically, there's no reason why you couldn't do client to client IPsec tunnels. But then it means having a lot of sort of exchanges of key material.
Have you looked at WireGuard, John?
I haven't yet. So it's on my ever-growing to-do list.
Yeah, I've got one of those.
I know that the SysAdministrivia podcast, I think it is.
Oh, yeah.
I think they had a session where they were talking about WireGuard.
Oh, okay. I must listen to that.
One of the hosts on that podcast was, I wouldn't say negative about WireGuard, but he said that it didn't match his requirements because he's typically looking for something that you only really tend to get with something that's been around a bit longer. So he's looking for, you know, large swathes of users connecting into an endpoint, which is more efficient to do with OpenVPN.
Right.
Or IPsec. And his criticism was that effectively, the way that WireGuard is written, it's effectively just like, here's a point-to-point connection stood up between two hosts, and you then need to define that you're going to route traffic down it and stuff like that. And he said it's just a lot more complicated stuff you have to stand up inside that WireGuard connection.
But I was watching I put links in the show notes on YouTube with the guy who wrote it, whatever, and it seemed really easy to set up. And then you just point traffic to go down it. So I want to have a play at it at some point.
Yeah, it's kind of the new kid on the block, isn't it? Yeah, I'd like to give it a try. I've got a client who I told about it, and he went off and looked at it independently. He's got this infrastructure that he did using Tink, which is another kind of software VPN, which, as far as I know, very Linuxy based. I used it once, but I was a bit too unknowledgeable in networking, and so I wanted to make it work. And I think I had a bit of a weird setup where I was using containers, and I was trying to route to containers on a private LAN on my server, and none of the documentation seemed to tell me how to do what I wanted to do. So I never got that working. But yeah, WireGuard might be good to try out.
One of the things you're saying about it being very easy to stand a WireGuard VPN up, a few episodes back on this podcast, I linked to a talk done by one of the guys that's the maintainer of OpenSWAN, FreeSWAN, one of the IPsec things. And actually the VPN, IPsec VPN configuration file is now down to something like six lines at each end as well.
Right.
And if you think about it, IPsec's been around quite a lot longer.
Yeah,
and it's actually baked into most of the OSs now,
yeah,
which WireGuard really isn't.
Or even OpenVPN. I mean, you know, for instance, iOS has maybe not an IPsec client, but a lot of them do.
All of the operating systems since I think it was Windows 95 have had an IPsec client built into them.
Have they?
Might be 98.
Wow.
Yeah. They may not necessarily do IPsec with IKEV2, which is the current kind of preferred way of doing things. They might not do NAT traversal, but they all have IPsec clients built into them.
The thing with WireGuard, it seems to me that it's kind of built along the lines of, you know, Unix, using the Unix philosophy, do one thing, do it well. So things like, there's other bits and bobs of software. So one that springs to mind is Prometheus, where it expects a direct connection to its master or whatever, or the master expects a direct connection to the thing it's trying to monitor.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that you build your own encryption layer on top of that. So it seems that something like WireGuard with a simple setup, or even IPsec, you know, maybe can do that layer, and you're just building up layers and making it work like that.
Can I ask, John, what's NAT traverse? Is that where you can enable it behind, if you're behind a NAT firewall?
Yeah. So, one of the quirks about, IKEV1 is that, in fact, I think you mentioned it before, is that it expects to have an endpoint-to-endpoint direct connection, and that uses an IP protocol. So whereas you're used to talking about sort of TCP and UDP as being protocols, they're actually just numbered IP protocols. I think it's something like 6 and 9 or something like that. There's another IP protocol, which is from memory, I think it's 45, which is, and again, this is me kind of racking my brains. I think it's called ISACAMP, ISAKMP. That's the internet shared key exchange. So it's not that. But effectively IPsec is about 4 different protocols wrapped up in one piece. And one of these is protocol, I think, 45. But that doesn't handle NAT at all. And so a lot of the very early issues. So one of the things that you tend to find with VPNs is that routers had to enable like a NAT pass-through, so a VPN pass-through mode. And effectively what that was doing was if it saw an IPsec connection coming through, it would basically just say all return traffic on that port 45 protocol 45 needs to go back to this specific host that lives behind me. And if you didn't have that on, then you needed to do NAT traversal, and not all of the implementations of IPsec would do NAT traversal. So for example, Checkpoint have only introduced NAT traversal in something like the last 5 years, and only in when it's configured in specific configurations. IKEV2 is much more tolerant of NAT. So if you ever have any issues with where you've got an IKEV1 VPN that's not coming up properly, and one end behind something that's doing NAT, say for example it's on AWS or Azure, or it's in OpenStack, or it's behind a DSL line or something like that, literally all you need to do is either move it to IKEV2 or turn on NAT traversal on one of the endpoints. Realistically, both ends need to know about it. But if one end doesn't, but the other one is switched on, it can work. It can be a bit flaky, but it can work. Well, talking of sort of VPNs and tunnels, one of the things that I've been doing over the last sort of couple of weeks is I've actually been playing with IPv6. And part of that came about because one of my colleagues at work posted something at after the sort of Christmas break saying, you know, what's everyone been up to? I've been doing, and somebody else posted, I've been doing IPv6. And I was like, oh, I'd quite like to do that. But the ISP that I'm with in the UK is called Plusnet, and they don't do IPv6 at all, even though the ISP that they are owned by, which is BT, does do IPv6. So it's not that as a company they can't do it, it's just that they're choosing not to for whatever reason. It's fun, whatever. So if you're in the position where you want to try IPv6, but you don't have IPv6 available to you through your DSL provider or your whatever your internet service provider is, you can actually sign up with for a Hurricane Electric, what they call a tunnel broker tunnel, which is a IPv6 in an IPv4 tunnel. And essentially what happens is you set up something similar to an IPsec tunnel between your local host and your remote host. And it then you then Hurricane Electric then routes a massive block of addresses. It's, they call it /64, but that's basically setting half of the bits in the netmask, because you get 128 bits in a netmask in IPv6. So half of the bits are set to be directed at you. So that means you can have, I have to check how many addresses it is. It's larger than the number of IPv4 addresses are that are available today, all directed to your place of presence.
Have you got it redirected to one PC? Have you got it going to a router or something?
So I stood up a Raspberry Pi running Raspbian, and I'm using that to terminate it as a router. So all of the IPv6 traffic in my network goes through my Raspberry Pi, where it's then encapsulated in the 6-in-4 packet, sent to my DSL router, and then it goes out through the internet peering from, in my case, Plusnet to Hurricane Electric's peering point, and then comes out of their infrastructure back out onto the main internet. So I lose around about, I think it's about 10% speed by going down the IPv6 route. But what it does mean is that all of the hosts in my network are now, in theory, internet accessible without having to do NATing. It also means that a lot of DNS lookups and things like that will prefer IPv6. So you get faster DNS resolution if you've got IPv6, because it will try your IPv6 address first and then fall back to IPv4 if the IPv4 address isn't responding, if the IPv6 address isn't responding, rather. So you get faster connections for short-lived connections, which obviously for web browsing is what most of us are doing, really. And yeah, it's just generally quite a... It seems, like with most networking things, it seems like a bit of black magic, but it's all good. It's really quite straightforward.
So you're obviously given this /64 address, and I'm guessing if you got some sort of DHCP running on that Raspberry Pi, then doing IPv6, then, because I can't remember about so long ago, there's different types of IPv6, isn't there? Kind of thing. There's like a default one, which like Windows will try and use first, kind of thing, like link local or something.
With IPv4, they allocated a single address which covers your local host, which is the 127.0.0.0/8 subnet. And that 127.0.0.0/8 subnet can be used for anything on your local machine. When they started looking at IPv6, what they've basically done is said that each interface needs to have its own link local address. So if you've heard of the APIPA range, which is the 169.254.0.0/16 range, the link local is effectively like that. So each NIC gets an IPv6 link local address. And I forget what the prefix is, but it's something like FE08 or something like that. And when the NIC comes up, the first thing it does is it checks to see whether the link local address that it's allocated itself is known on your local network. And if it is, then it will give itself another link local address. So that one's non-deterministic. You can never guarantee to get the same link local address twice. But once it's got that, it then uses that link local address to start looking for the other stuff that's on the network.
So it's like a discovery thing.
Yeah. But it also means that you typically tend to have like 3, 4, 5. Well, so I'm using DNS Mask to provide like the DHCP service for my network. And DNS Mask will do DHCP v6, which is kind of like DHCP for an IPv4 network. So it'll do things like, you know, these are DNS servers, this is your gateway, this is your IP address, and so on and so forth. But there's also another thing called router announcements. So instead of on an IPv4 network, where you have to, by some mechanism, determine what the next hop is on your network, and it typically comes from a DHCP service. On IPv6, you can instead have this RA thing, which is where every time that link local address pops up and says, is there anyone out there? The RA service says, I'm here as a router. Allocate yourself an address in my range. So that /64 that I've got, the RA service says, I'm the router for this /64. So everything in your network will have the same 64-bit prefix and a random 64-bit suffix. That's called RA mode. So you've got your link local, you've got RA mode, you've got DHCP v6, and then there's another one called SLAAC, which is where it takes the MAC address of the interface, puts another 2 octet bytes in the middle of that to make 64 bits, and then injects that after the 64 bits prefix. So you've got these potentially 4 or 5, like I said, on my network, any of the interfaces on my network are coming up with 5 or 6 IPv6 addresses per interface, which is a bit bonkers.
Why is that? Is this the way it is? Why would you have those different methods?
SLAAC, I think, is one of the very early models, which is not particularly privacy considerate. One of the things that's a negative about MAC addresses is that the first 3 bytes of each IPv6, so of each MAC address, is statically assigned to a vendor.
Correct.
So if you know that first 3 bytes, say, for example, that says Western Digital. It wouldn't be Western Digital, but, you know, Samsung. And you know that there's a vulnerability in Samsung devices, you can then say, aha, I recognize this is a Samsung device on that network attack. So there's a privacy downside to that. Also, the fact that it's a static address every single time, because you have the same prefix, you have the same address. And one of the things about IPv6 is you're supposed to have, every device is supposed to have its own IPv6 address that's publicly accessible, or not necessarily publicly accessible, but publicly addressable, means that, you know, you might, if you're the sort of person that has a, you know, internet connected toaster, that means that in theory, if you haven't got the right firewall rules in place, your toaster is addressable by the internet.
Yeah, because that's the thing I was worried about IPv6, is that if you, everything's accessible, isn't it? Because everything has a routable address.
Well, I think you've got to remember the intention was with the IPv4 space was that there's a couple of things, and that turned out to be good for security because you could hide your network behind a router. But that was the idea that everything on the internet should be addressable.
Yeah.
Before security became an issue and so on.
And before IPv4 exhaustion.
Yeah.
But yeah, so you're right. Every node is supposed to be addressable. And this is part of the reason why every node is only supposed to advertise the services that it should be advertising. So one of the things that I would hope to start seeing is that the sorts of protections you typically get in an IPv4 home network is that your boundary router only lets certain packets inbound.
It's probably a good architectural thing that the routers are already there, because people would, you know, happily replace their router with an IPv6 compatible one, which will do the necessary firewalling for the host, the globally addressable host that are sitting in their network.
So one of the things that I did as I was going through this, as is relatively typical for me, is that I actually have been blogging about kind of what I built as I was building it. And the thing that I do before I do any of the IPv6 routing on this Raspberry Pi that I've built is I actually have the firewall configured to deny inbound connections. And realistically, if you're not defining your network like that, you are opening yourself up to kind of like a world of hurt.
You're saying, just to follow up on that, you're saying you're routing through the Raspberry Pi, but the Raspberry Pi only has one interface, or does it?
It does only have one interface.
How are you then routing? Because that implies having an interface in both, in two networks. Well, maybe it doesn't. Please correct me.
What happens? So effectively, the way that the connection to Hurricane Electric works is it's like setting up an IPsec tunnel or a VPN tunnel. In fact, they call it a 6-in-4 tunnel. So when you start the 6-in-4 service up, what you are effectively doing is establishing a VPN from an interface on your machine to a server in the cloud.
There is quite an important concept here, which I've got nowhere near as much experience as you guys, but I did this course in networking and they talked about encapsulation and demultiplexing. So if you think about the OSI model, which is obviously we talked about before, it's flawed, but when you put something on the network, you put it through these layers and you encapsulate the higher layers into the lower layers, transmit it over the network. And then when you get to the other end, you demultiplex that. So you've got all this stuff bound together, which has gone over a fiber cable across the Atlantic or whatever. When it gets to the other end, you bring it up through the layers again, and then you get your packet to where it's going. And that's probably quite an important concept in all this talk of VPNs and so on. That's probably quite an important concept. It made a lot of things clear to me when I learned about that.
Yeah, it's a really good point. I mean, that's we mentioned before about how SSH some people consider to be a poor man's VPN. Effectively, all that the various different stacks of IP, TCP, UDP, GRE, all of these different things are basically just multiplexes on a lower layer. So TCP is a multiplex on IP. IP is a multiplex on a cable. You know, so you're right, absolutely. And a VPN is literally just a multiplex that lives on top of ICMP, TCP, UDP.
So you can think of like think about words going into one end and then they get encapsulated in something else, an encryption layer or transport layer or whatever, and then they get transmitted as basically electrons down the wire. And when they get to the other end, the software or the hardware at the other end can open up those layers again and then get a sort of more structured bit of data to the destination. Because both ends have agreed on protocols and so on.
Yeah, because I've, with the IPv6, it was always quite scary, but talking about it today, it's kind of made me more interested about it and actually want to start playing with it. I think it's just getting your head around it, how it works, isn't it, really, and understanding the whole, because you don't like assign, whatever it's a 64-bit address, you aren't going to sit there and type in 64 addresses, i.e. into an IP address on a server or whatever, i.e. so no, most of the things you do with IPsec is all done by is by assigning an address to it.
Or it'll be these other layers of things on top of IPv6, which will use IPv6 in a different way, I suppose. So the applications themselves will become IPv6 aware eventually and be able to use all these features and so on, which is really different from the way networks work at the moment.
And I didn't also like the idea of how scary it is if you put everything on the internet and it's findable. But I mean, if it isn't, if you think about it the other way around, is if someone's trying to scan your network, they've got to scan so many thousands of hosts before they actually find something.
It won't become a problem until quantum computing takes off.
But then you, where you were saying it, John, about that actually you could stop it, you could stop all incoming connections, like it would be like a NAT firewall, so that you do it so that you only let connections back in which initiated internally, so that you, that you know that the connect, the packet is allowed to come back in.
And I think a lot of things like I get things like IP tables and all this other stuff has had support for IPv6 for a long time, you know, for many, I mean, I can remember setting up Linux in the early days, you know, 2000 sort of era, and it was saying about IPv6 support. So I think a lot of that lower level stuff is already there and has been there for almost decades. So it's just waiting for people to take advantage of it. And which they will eventually have to do because of IPv4 address exhaustion and all that.
Okay, I think that's all about IPv6. Maybe I'll have a play before the next show and I'll let you know how I get on.
Well, like I said, so I wrote a blog post that kind of walks you through being able to set this up and probably start to end. If you include sort of burning the image onto the SD card, you're probably looking about half an hour to get everything stood up. If you're comfortable with doing Linuxy things, and if you're not, you're probably looking at maybe an hour to an hour and a half, possibly. It's certainly not a complicated thing to do. And the amount of, again, the thing that I always found best about using Linux was that it taught you much more about how an operating system works, because you get involved in, you know, you being able to do packet captures, you being able to, you know, route traffic over the box. You get to do all these things which you can't, you can do it in Windows, but it's much more complicated to do.
So what have you been up to then, Jerry? You were talking about SaltStack or something you wanted to mention.
Yeah, again, well, I mean, this is one of my first freelance clients that I've been working for days at a time. So that's a bit of an achievement for me in the sort of ongoing saga of my freelance work. But this guy is using SaltStack, or Salt, as it's sometimes known. I think they changed it to SaltStack because of Googling. It's like Google changed Go or to Golang, or it became known as Golang because it was easier to Google Golang than Go. Anyway, it's I'd actually heard about SaltStack before I'd heard about Ansible, so that places it back probably about 5 years ago. And it's a config management system. It seems it comes across as a bit of a sort of amalgamation of Puppet and Ansible. So Ansible is written in Python, so's Salt. It uses a master-slave model, or that's probably not, we shouldn't be using those terms in these enlightened times. And actually they call it masters and minions, which is great because it conjures up like Despicable Me and all that stuff. And so you have a master which you put the configuration on, and then the minions talk back to the master, get their configuration from there, and then they configure themselves. So it's kind of, it's like a desired state thing rather than with Ansible, where you're giving explicit commands to over SSH to configure the box in a certain way. So I did a couple of Ansible bits of work involving Ansible for config management. And he actually spent some time porting that to Salt, because the reason he's doing this is he's got his clients are behind NAT routers. So we were talking about NAT traversal earlier. So one way of traversing NAT is having you establish a connection to the, in this case, the minion, and tell it to talk to the master. You don't have control about the network on the minion end, but you have control about the network on the master end. You can allow traffic to come from a minion to a master through any router. So that's the reason, that's his use case, and that's why he's using Salt for this. So I've been having to learn a bit of Salt. So I've been working for almost four or five years with Ansible, and I've got a way of working with Ansible that I've come to over these years, and now probably having to adapt this to Salt. It's interesting. It's got YAML config files, if you like. Ansible, I would say, is more of a programming language in YAML, in a way. YAML and Jinja. Salt uses Jinja, so you can write your templates the way you've always done. But you can also use Jinja, or you're kind of encouraged to use Jinja to define variables. So you can, for instance, you can loop your variables, or you can have a for loop for your variables. You can use loops in other ways in the config management stuff, which is a lot of the stuff you do with Ansible is using loops to loop through data structures like lists or dictionaries. In Salt, you can define those dictionaries using those loops and so on. So it's potentially a lot less actual lines of code that you're writing for your Salt configuration. This master minion model is also, it seems to be fairly quick, whereas with Ansible, you're often, if you're working in that way, you're going from your Ansible control machine, running this list of commands, which can take a long time sometimes. If you've pushed out a Salt configuration to your minions, it's often very quick. The minion software will determine the best way to run the commands, or the way that you've defined to run the commands, and it'll just do it. And it seems a lot quicker. It's quite early days yet. I only really just got my head around it a couple of days ago. So something to report back on in the future.
One of the people that's in the Admin podcast Telegram channel was asking about recommendations on what node management software he should be looking at for one of his clients. So they've got a collection of, I think it's laptops or desktops or something, that are not always on. And obviously one of the things that Ansible benefits from is kind of that it's designed really to work with boxes that are always on. Whereas with things like Salt, Puppet and Chef, because they call home to get updates, and they call home on a, you know, semi-regular basis, in theory you could have an estate that is managed by by Puppet, Salt or Chef, purely on the fact that they are calling home to get updates, which you don't get with Ansible.
There's quite a few things like I haven't done anything with it, but there's a event driven kind of thing. So I guess you could say if this condition is met, then run this configuration or something like that. But need to report back on that when I know a bit more about it. It does look interesting though.
And did you say you've been doing some LAMP stack with Ansible as well?
Another bit of freelance work I'm doing is to build a LAMP stack for a client. So this involves building one web server and one MySQL server. The web server is running WordPress. So that's PHP, Apache, and a MySQL database sitting on the other server. It was quite surprising to me that this wasn't really a solved problem, or not in the way that I ended up solving it. And all the little bits and bobs that I had to do to get it working meant that I severely underestimated the amount of time it was going to take. When you're a freelancer, people want you to give estimates and quotes and things, and it's good to not to estimate say 2 days and it takes 4 days, which is what ended up happening. There were lots of little moving parts that I hadn't really taken into consideration and which I didn't already have answerable code for. So one of those is when you're with WordPress, you need to define a database name and a database password. And what I wanted to do was randomly generate the password for the database. But you've then immediately got a problem of if you generate that, you've got to distribute it to the web server node and the MySQL node. They both got to have those credentials somehow, which isn't particularly easy to do in Ansible. Can be done, actually, but the way I decided to do it was using Credstash. Credstash is a little Python utility which uses, it talks to AWS and it uses the KMS, which is the key management service, and DynamoDB, which is basically their database as a service. And it uses that to, so KMS will take your key value pair, username, password effectively, and it will encrypt it using an encryption key which you define, and then it will stick those, that key and value into DynamoDB. So it's really quite handy once you get it working. I had a bit of trouble getting it working, and the only reason for that was the encryption keys are region specific. So my AWS credentials were logging into, in this case, EU West 1 in Dublin. Might have to be different after Brexit, but there we go. And I couldn't get Credstash working because the encryption keys were in, I created them in North Virginia or somewhere. So that it's sensitive to that. But after that, it's really easy to use. And the reason I used Credstash was because Ansible has a Credstash lookup, as they call it. So it can interface directly with Credstash. Another thing was IP tables. You know, I'd built the servers, I got the LAMP stack working, I got WordPress working, but I realised I had to configure the firewalls on these machines so that they, for instance, so the web server only needs to allow SSH, so I can SSH into it and do my Ansible stuff and configure it, and port 80 and port 443, that's all it needs. So I decided to do it properly and set up a firewall, IP tables firewall on that machine. The MySQL server will only need port 3306, and that port will only need to talk to, or it will only need to be addressable from the web server. So there's another firewall rule there. And the other thing, which took me probably half a day to work out, so this is what I'm talking about, estimating time properly, was SE Linux. It's a security implementation that you get on Red Hat based servers, actually invented by the NSA. Yet another reason to hate them, I would say. Before this point, one contract I had to deal with SE Linux. And it's actually okay, but it can, if you don't realise it's there, it can cause a lot of problems, which is, I generally don't realise it's there until many hours later. The way that you deal with it, you set it up, and so it has three different modes, permissive, enforcing, and off. Those are the three modes. Permissive will log anything that you're trying to do, and it will still let it through. Enforcing will not let anything through unless you specifically allow it, and you do this by writing these policies. Now I couldn't write one of these policies by hand, but luckily there's a little utility called audit to allow, which will basically give you the magic bit of code which you need to get SE Linux to let the things through that need letting through. There may be more things, but the things that I've come into contact with that it controls are files. So files effectively have a bit of metadata attached to them, which tells them what they're allowed to do. So you might be able to say that this file isn't accessible by Apache, for instance, or it is accessible by Apache, but you have to specifically allow that. And you can basically feed your what's called the audit.log, varlog audit.log. You can feed that into this utility, and it will give you the bit of SE Linux policy that you need to make it all work.
So it's typically things like the web server logs. don't turn up because you told it to log into a different place than it was expecting them to go to.
Yeah, yeah, that's it, yeah. And things like your MySQL data directory isn't allowed. It's only allowed in Varlib MySQL and unless you give it a good reason not to, or you tell the system that it's allowed to have it have that somewhere else.
So you mentioned that you were set up IP tables rules. Is there any reason why you went for IP tables versus something like UFW, which is the uncomplicated firewall?
Well, UFW is a layer over IP tables, right?
Yes, it is. But from an administration perspective, with IP tables, you need to be able to sort of sit down and it's not to say you can't read IP tables rules. But so, for example, with IP tables, you end up with a file called iptables.save. And in that, you've got something like -a input, S port, you know, 1234, D port, 45672, and then a number, you know, an IP address, allow and stuff like that. Whereas with UFW, although, yes, it writes those rules for you, when you do, you know, UFW status, you get allow from IP to IP on port. And you get a line that just defines it like that. So the blog post that I wrote about IPv6, I use UFW to do all of the policy management for that. And there's some really easy to understand Ansible modules for UFW as well.
In this case, it was actually, I think, I don't know if you can get it for CentOS, but these machines were CentOS. So I know they've got Firewall D, but I've also found this Ansible, it's a library actually, it's an external module, so it's not available in Ansible, called IP tables raw, and that lets you define specific IP tables rules and you can give them a weight. So I've got rule, and then reject everything else, and you can have that rule right at the bottom. You can have like your SSH and so on rules at the top, and then stick everything else in the middle. So it's quite handy like that. And I hadn't had to deal with IP tables until only a few years ago, really. Up until that point, I hadn't worked with it at all. So I'm sure it's second nature to most people, but and it seems like it is second nature to most people, but it really confused me for a long time. And I finally got my head around it when I realized that it went top to bottom. So it's like the packet comes in, at least in a simple form, it comes into the input chain, and then it goes through each rule in turn. And then if it makes it through there, or if it makes it to the bottom and it doesn't match anything, then it's just rejected anyway.
That's a really good point. One of the things that I found a few years back was actually there's a block diagram showing each of the different phases that IP tables works through. So it goes through raw pre-routing, mangle pre-routing, NAT pre-routing. There's then a routing decision where it can either be mangled and forwarded, or filter forwarded, or it mangle input, filter input, local processes, routing decision, routed output, mangled output, NAT output, filter output, routing decision, and that's where the forward bit sort of gets merged back in, and then you mangle post-routing and NAT post-routing. So you have that kind of long chain of things really there, which I'll see if I can find where it was. I found that image a few years back because I've had that stuck to the wall in my office sort of pretty much since then.
Can we put a note in so we can talk about mangled next time?
Yeah.
Because I know that we were talking to the Binary Time guys about microticks, and the one thing about microticks is the firewalling on them is it's got all about mangles and NATs and stuff. And like there's like a diagram on there which shows you the process. And I'm always confused about what you meant to do, but depending on what.
It's always intrigued me, the mangle bit.
Well, some mangling when it comes to packets is basically adjusting the content of the packet. So the most typical situation where you'll see that is if you imagine, or if you recall, active and passive FTP.
Mm-hmm.
So with active FTP, when you open up a connection, it expects there to be a socket, an open port on port 20 for the data channel on the client that you connect from. So you're connecting as the client to the server, but the server then expects there to be a port open on port 20 on the client for it to talk back to. If you have got a firewall that understands FTP, it will rewrite the data, the control channel, to tell it what the IP address is and the port it needs to go back to without having to use passive FTP. However, if you're doing passive FTP, when you connect, it sends a statement saying passive, and then the server replies with an address to talk back to, which again is an IP address and port. So that's where the data port is on that. What Mangle can do is it can either work with the client end, where the client says, I want to talk FTP, and it's going to rewrite the source address. It can Mangle that port that it's going to talk back to then. Or if you're doing passive FTP and you've got a firewall in front of your passive FTP server, when the FTP server says this is the port to talk back to, the mangling is where it's actually amending the packets at that point to say it's not going to be going to, you know, 192.0.2.1. It's going to be going to, you know, 1.2.3.4 on port, whatever it is. So it's actually where it modifies the packets, because it knows what the packets look like, and that's mangling.
Mm. Okay. Did someone have some podcasts, a new podcast I've been listening to, wanted to mention?
Yes, I have been listening to lots of new podcasts. So I have been listening to Malicious Life. So I've previously mentioned that I listen to Hackable, which is a podcast from McAfee. Malicious Life is a podcast from, and I can't remember who it's by now, but it's from another vendor. And one of the interesting things about Malicious Life is that they record every other week, but on the other weeks, they are playing other podcasts, other security podcasts. So they've recently played Darknet Diaries, which is another podcast that I recommend.
Yeah.
So that's one of them. There's The Self-Hosted Web, which is about hosting web applications and services inside your own network. He's only on episode something like 5 or 6. But again, it's a very good podcast, and it's been relatively well researched, and audio quality is pretty good. But I think he's a podcaster for other things anyway. And the last one is a podcast called Getting Into InfoSec, where there's an interview each episode with somebody that's getting into InfoSec, talking about how they got into it and, you know, what they do and how it works. So it's basically helping people that want to get involved in network security, kind of getting them stood up.
I've been listening to Risky Business recently. It's quite a nice sort of, I mean, I would say I listen less to security now and more to Risky Business, talking of InfoSec.
Yeah. I found that as well.
It's less explainy, you know, there's more of an assumption of, you know, what they're talking about, and just sort of getting to the point, I suppose. I've been listening to, I just started listening to probably in the last week or two, is Real World DevOps. So John, you mentioned a newsletter called Monitoring Weekly a few episodes ago, and the guy that does that, does this Real World DevOps podcast. I just quite like the way it's pitched. It's a bit like Arrested DevOps, if anyone listens to that. I liked it because they talk a bit more about the tech than about the sort of the way that you build DevOps teams, or the way, you know, what DevOps means and all this kind of stuff. It's more about as the title suggests, how you do that kind of thing in the real world. So yeah, recommended. It seems quite professionally produced and so on. So yeah, I enjoyed it.
Whilst we're talking about plugging things, a friend of the show, Joe Ressington, is running Foss Talk Live later on this year. If you head over to fosstalk.com, you will find details about the event. It's on the 8th of June at the Harrison, near King's Cross in London. The event has sold out, but as Joe likes to advise people, it's
just a group of
geeks in a pub. And it's basically, it's a group of it's a group of tech podcasters sitting around and basically doing a live recording of their podcasts. Now, I don't know who else is going to be on the stage, but I do believe that there will be some representation from the Ubuntu podcast. There will be some representation from Late Night Linux, and there may or may not be some representation from the Bug Report podcast, which was previously known as Linux Voice, and before that, Linux Format.
There's also Linux Lads.
Oh, are Linux Lads going, are they? Oh, right, excellent. So that's one event. And the other event that we're going to probably be promoting for most of the rest of this year is OggCamp. I'm not involved in organising it this year, but I am intending to attend, seeing as it's only in Manchester, which is only about half an hour down the road from me.
I've never been to Manchester.
You've never been to Manchester? No. Oh, well. The delights I can show you. It's going to be on the 19th and 20th of October. That's a Saturday and a Sunday. And as with all of these type of events, if you can get there on the Friday night and leave on the Monday morning, so much the better. The venue itself hasn't been announced yet, but the dates have been and the location has been. So if you're planning to come to OggCamp, it'd be great to see you there.
I'll be there.
Yeah, I will hopefully be there.
So the reason why I'm not organising it this year is because my son is desperate to go to it. So I will be there, possibly with my son in tow, and quite possibly with my wife and daughter looking rather grumpy at the fact they've been dragged to a camp. Maybe not so much, but you know, perhaps.
There was a time when I might have been able to take my daughter and maybe my wife, but I think that time is long past.
Cool. Okay, I think we should wrap up then. So just doing normal things about thanking Dave for doing the production of the podcast. Thank you very much, Dave.
Thank you, Dave.
Also, pleasure to thank our Patreons. They are Andamo Deming, Dave Lee, and Yannick Mori. And John Spriggs is no longer donating for some reason. Don't know why.
does anyone know who that John Spriggs fellow is? I mean, he sounds like he might be a nice guy, but I'm not sure.
Yeah.
The other thing it's probably worth mentioning is that we are starting to get quite a bit more social with some of the other podcasts. So we're hoping that they're plugging our podcast to them. We're certainly plugging their podcasts to you guys.
So what podcast would that be?
We're definitely talking more to the guys from the Binary Times. And we're also talking at least a little bit to the guys from Iron Sysadmin and Linux Lads.
Have they been quiet lately with the podcast? I haven't seen a podcast then for a couple of weeks.
I listened to one of theirs the other day. I think I got a bit of a backlog. Sorry, guys.
Just find all the info on the admin podcast.co.uk. You had contact us, Patreon and Telegram group, which is getting quite active now. Interesting chatting in there. So we'll speak to everyone soon.
See you later.
Bye.